The matter now before the court is Waldo 2219, and that's Jeffrey Mabee et al. Versus Nordic Aqua Farms et al. We are streaming the oral argument in this case live on the web, and counsel appear ready to argue. I've been given the, I understand that the appellants are splitting the argument. Is that correct? Okay. Then, thank you, counsel. Perkins? And although I appreciate Justice Connor's colloquy, which I think has been illuminating many things, I'm going to jump in with a question because I think you're green right from the beginning.
Please do.
Can I ask you this? Assume, based on what the argument, that the 1946 deed is not ambiguous and did not convey the intertidal land to the poor family. How do you get the intertidal land in front of what are designated lots 35 and 36? How does that come to your clients, or how does it come to the Mabees? That
we're okay.
How is that conveyed? How do you make that leap?
First, you have to start with the understanding, and then you frame the question that way, that with the poor deed, the flats were retained by Harriet Hartley.
Assume that.
That was in 1946. 4 years later, in 1950, Hartley has sold off land across U.S. Route 1 to the Belfast District. She's down to her last piece of upland, and she sells that upland to the Butlers.
Correct.
Her intertidal land at that point is in front of her upland, and as you said, it's also in front of Fred Porch's property. At that point, she conveys a deed, and this is, she's selling the last of her land in Maine. Her record, her probate records are clear. She died very shortly after this, a couple years, two or three years later, no land in Maine. And the description calls for four natural monuments.
And those monuments do not extend in front of the other two lots.
No, they do. The first one is northerly, and if you the exhibit that Ms. Tucker just talked about.
Northerly by the land of Fred R. Poor.
Yeah, northerly by Poor.
Easterly by Penobscot Bay, southerly by Little River, and westerly by the Atlantic Highway.
And exactly. And the parties agreed that there were, in this case, there was a call to the sea. A call to the
sea. I understand that.
Right, and that was where the confusion was created by Nordic that carried over to the judge's decision.
But doesn't that call to the sea just really pertain to essentially the upland lots 37 and 38, intertidal land in front of 37 and 38? How do you get it to encompass the other intertidal land?
First of all, there's broad presumptions that when you own upland and you own intertidal land.
Didn't the judge make a finding that it didn't extend over to the title land of 36?
He did, but that you are making a de novo review of this deed and interpreting this deed.
Okay, so then return then to the 1946 deed to Cassata.
Could I finish your question? No, because you asked me about why it doesn't capture the land in front of Port, and I want to answer that. So you have a deed that has these monuments. There's no expression in the deed that Hartley was retaining anything. You have the colonial ordinance presumption triggered that broadly presumes that the intertidal land is conveyed. And finally, if there's ambiguity about what you're talking about, up about Poor, by Poor, that ambiguity in any deed by law is construed against Hartley in favor of the Butlers. And then the final point is, Nordic made this argument that the Emerson case that Ms. Tucker talked about specifies how you create intertidal boundary lines. Nordic argued for, and on the Exhibit 66, it shows the two intertidal boundary lines determined by Emerson versus Taylor. Nordic argued that there should be a third boundary in the middle of Harriet Hartley's flats. But if you read the Emerson versus Taylor case, it talks about using that methodology for creating intertidal land when you have division of upland parcels where the parcels own the flats.
Well, let me, I'm going to interrupt you.
The parcel did not own the flat.
Because what I don't understand then is, you know, what we're really talking about is when you convey the intertidal land, are you really only conveying the intertidal land in front of the lot or not? But if you go to the Cassata deed from 1946, in that, it specifically says, also conveying whatever right, title, or interest I may have in and to the land between high and low water marks of Penobscot Bay. Doesn't that therefore convey, if I follow your theory, doesn't that convey all of her intertidal land at that point, including the intertidal land that is later in front of the upland that was conveyed to Butler in 1950?
No, because she's not conveying all of her upland. This is not her final conveyance.
Well, but there's not language in the 1950 deed that says, you know, everything I own or anything like that, is there? As there often is, in other words, meaning and in intending to convey all of my interest.
I'd like to read a quote from Nordic's surveyor, and this is in Plaintiffs 3. James Dorsky says, it's common for deeds conveying land along the shore, even when the language in the description clearly includes the flats, to not specify what portion of the flats is being conveyed. When the description fails to clearly describe the boundaries of the flats being conveyed, Maine courts have long held that the method for determining those limits or the direction of the property line from high to low water is the colonial method, which is determined by Emerson versus Taylor. So, The analysis of the Butler deed focused on the fact that there wasn't more clarity as to where the intertidal boundaries were. But if you have a final piece of land being sold and you follow those rules of construction that I just said, and there's no basis under Emerson versus Taylor to make a new intertidal division in the middle of Hartley's property, and then finally you construe the ambiguity that you're talking about. If you view that deed as ambiguity,
I'm not
you
sure
construe
it's ambiguous.
Against
That's
Hartley.
The problem, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
that assumes it's ambiguous, but go ahead.
Yeah, and we've taken the position all along that it's not ambiguous. Recall, this is 1950. You have the first deed, which is clearly not ambiguous, the poor deed, where Hartley had a lot of reasons to be very specific because she was retaining land on both sides of that upland that she was selling to Poor. And then when she did the Cassata parcel, which was the furthest north, she clearly conveyed the flats by that specific language. In 1950, she's selling everything and she uses a more general deed that was very common in that time period. And it just describes the encircling monuments, describes the abutted to the north, and triggers the colonial presumption, and doesn't retain any of the land. At that point, the court is left with two choices. You can interpret the Butler deed, as we are suggesting, with the rules of construction and any ambiguity being construed against Hartley, or you would have to determine that Hartley kept a little piece of flats just for her enjoyment, right, in her 76 year of life, and that is illogical.
Thank you, counsel. And for appellant.